Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason, and thank you for being part of our show today, our program. And there's been a lot of things happening kind of roughly on Capitol Hill, especially with SCOTUS, the Supreme Court of the United States of America, and it has to do with the abortion issue. And so I thought the best person to talk to about that issue is my buddy, friend, longtime colleague, erstwhile director of ethics at Stand to Reason, currently founder and president of Life Training Institute, Mr. Scott Klusendorf. Scotty boy, good to see you again.
Greg, always good to see you. What a joy to be with you.
Thank you. I was going to almost say welcome back, you know, but I guess...
Please do.
You were eight years with us at STR?
You know, something like that, seven or eight.
Now how long with LTI?
We started LTI toward the end of 2004, so I'm bad at math. What is that?
That's a long time.
Yeah.
Well, that would be like 2004 to 2020 is 16 plus one. How about that?
There
17.
You go. 17
you're
years.
Moving along there. Good for you.
Yep.
And I'm so proud of the work you're doing, and we work with some of your people. Megan Allman, for example, has been helping us out at Realities, doing a
She's
fabulous
something special,
job.
She's something special, isn't she?
Unbelievable. You know, we do a review after every reality, and everybody gets assessed, you know, very mm-hmm. carefully. And she is the one who escapes harm every single time. No one has anything negative to say about her presentation. How can you improve on that, you know?
You can't hate her. It's impossible.
She was trained by the best there, Mr. Klusendorf, so
she does a
great job.
I kind of think she makes us better rather than the other way around, but we're really glad to be sharing her with you, and you are welcome to use her services any way that helps Stand to Reason. We're happy to do that.
Oh, that's great. It's great working together here with our organizations. The issue today, though, that I'd like you to help me out with is the front and center is the Dobbs case. And this came up before SCOTUS, I think, last week as they started arguments. It was a big deal. Lots of people outside cheering for one side or the other. I'm really interested right now in having you help us to understand what this case is about, what are some of the legal angles, and what's at stake with Dobbs. SCOTUS has been, 48 years and counting. I'm sorry, Roe v. Wade has been 48 years and counting. That's a long time for a precedent to be in place. Tell us about Dobbs and how that came about and the genesis of it, the rationale, the strategy behind it, and the present status of the discussions.
Here's the one question that will clarify it for everyone, because it's easy to get lost in the weeds of these cases. Here's mm-hmm. the key question being debated. Can states limit abortion before fetal viability? That's the issue. Strip away everything else. That's the issue. Now, two Supreme Court cases, Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, say no, states may not limit abortion before viability, at least not substantially so, because such limits would constitute an undue burden on the woman who wishes to abort. So Supreme Court precedent says that the Mississippi law that bans abortion after 15 weeks is unconstitutional because it fails the undue burden test. So the key question, again, is simply this. Can states ban or restrict abortion, limit the evil of it, before fetal viability? Now, in order for the court to uphold the Mississippi law, the court is going to have to do something about Roe and Casey, and that's the genius of this. And this is why I'm very confident, probably more confident than I've ever been, that we stand a very good chance of seeing Roe and Casey tossed aside by the court, because you cannot have support for a 15-week fetal abortion ban when Roe v. Wade and Casey say that it's not until 24 weeks you can have those meaningful restrictions.
So
go ahead.
Let me interject something here, Scott, because I haven't read very much on this, just a little bit. But to me, there was actually two questions, whether there would be a modification of the limitations that Roe placed on abortion legislation, yeah, or whether Roe would be tossed entirely. You just talked about tossing it. Is that realistically the only option because the language of Roe and Casey is so clear about the 24-week limit?
Well, here's the thing. I don't think the court can modify Roe and Casey without looking incredibly ad hoc and arbitrary. What are you going to do? Just move the viability line from 24 weeks to, what, 14 weeks? And what's going to be your rationale for doing that? So the court really has a problem. And the reason it has a problem is due to the skill of the attorney general in Mississippi, Lynn Fitch, who did a terrific job of framing this issue, not as an issue that she was requesting the court narrowly support, meaning her specific law, but mm-hmm. she went for the whole enchilada and said, hey, Brock, Roe and Casey were wrongly decided. Let's get them out of the way. Then there's no problem with our law. Hmm. And she did us all a huge, courageous favor by doing that. And that's precisely the point that we saw Scott Stevenson arguing before the Supreme Court. He was arguing that, look, Roe and Casey were wrongly decided. They're bad history. They're bad jurisprudence. And they ought to be tossed aside. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think is going to happen. I really think we're going to see Roe and Casey put aside.
Yeah, well, the two thoughts that come to me, one is about viability. If I forget about that, bring me back to it, Scott.
Yeah.
But I want to make a distinction here that is rarely made in these discussions about the notion of a conservative justice. And I think, and you know this problem, Scott, when most people think of the word conservative applied to a justice, they are thinking politically conservative, and it's one side stacking the court for their political concerns. That's not what we're talking about here.
No.
We're not talking about political conservatives. We're talking about judicial conservatives, and that's a very different enterprise. Can you explain the distinction?
Absolutely. In fact, what we want as conservatives are not, quote, pro-life justices. We want justices that will interpret the Constitution and be faithful to the rule of law as written there. And if they do that, we believe they will be pro-life in the sense that they're certainly not going to put forward anything as radical as Roe and Casey allow.
So because what it's not in the Constitution.
It's not in the Constitution. Now, right. I will tell you, I don't know the mind of the justices because I don't know any of them. But here's my best guess, that Thomas and Alito would probably be philosophically pro-life. The rest of the justices that are possibly going to vote to overturn Roe and Casey, I'm not sure where they're at, but I think they don't want the court involved in the politics of abortion, which is what has happened for the last nearly 50 years. They would rather return this to the states. Now, of course, as pro-lifers, simply returning it to the states is not our end game. We want every child throughout pregnancy protected in law. But at least now we are allowed to fight, where Roe v. Wade basically co-opted the issue from the people and said the federal courts alone will decide this issue. The legislative and executive branches have no say whatsoever. So now if the court sends this back to the states by reversing Roe and Casey, we, the people, will have a chance to have our voice heard, and we can pass much tougher abortion laws than what we currently see. I mean, right now, what we see are basically abortion control legislation, which, given what we're up against, is the best good we can do. But we want to go far, far beyond that. We want every child protected from conception forward. And that's going to mean we've got to get rid of Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which stand in the way of that.
Yeah, you know what this reminds me of a little bit is Judge Taney and his infamous decision there to keep to allow the expansion of slavery into the territories in the Dred Scott decision. And I'm just thinking there was no opportunity in the late 1850s to end slavery, but there was an opportunity to limit it and limit its expansion. And that was at stake in that particular case. I know that there is a sentiment in the pro-life movement that says it's all or nothing for us. It's all or nothing. Now, you and I have never been in favor of that approach because our goal is to save as many lives as possible. If we can't save 100, but we can save 10, what's wrong with that is our view. So I imagine, I mean, in this particular discussion with the Dobbs case, this is more like an all or nothing circumstance based on what you just described. I do have some other questions about it, but that has the potential then, at least on a federal level, on the Supreme Court level, of unifying these two disparate groups within the pro-life movement.
What are your thoughts on that? Yeah, I think so. And here's the thing. I do believe there are some pro-lifers that are way too timid. They're unwilling to push the envelope, and they're unwilling to advance legislation that could really help us move forward. On the other hand, as you mentioned, there are people who basically take an all-or-nothing approach, and they say it's wrong to incrementally limit the evil done. We can only settle for a complete protection law for all children. Well, if we get Roe and Casey out of the way, pro-life states don't have a lot of excuse for moving forward with very strong pro-life legislation. And it allows us then to say to these state legislatures that are filled with people we elected who claim to be pro-life, hey, wait a minute, you said you were going to be pro-life on this. We've gotten the courts out of the way now. What's your problem? And we're going to be able to hold their feet to the fire on this. And that's a good thing.
Let's go back to this viability issue, Scott. The problem with viability, it seems to me, is that I'm trying to think of the right term to describe. What I want to say is something like medical or scientific, but there is no such thing as an age of viability. That keeps moving. Those goalposts keep moving with the improvement of science and neonatal care. So what, you know, you can have preemies now born much earlier that are viable in that sense, and which does raise a question, why is it that the value of a human life is based on the advancement of science and not on the life itself? You know, well, you know the drill, but go ahead and talk about that a little bit.
In fact, Scott Stewart argued this in front of the Supreme Court. He was making the point that there's no rational basis for viability, either in the sense of jurisprudence in law or in medical necessity. I mean, imagine this. You've got a woman in New York who is about to board a plane. She's pregnant. She's 21 weeks pregnant. Well, her child at that point is probably viable in a modern New York hospital. Now, assume she leaves American airspace and she's flying, let's say, to Bangladesh. She enters Bangladesh airspace where viability might not be till week 30 because they don't have the medical technology we have in New York. Does her child go from being human while it's in American airspace to non-human while it's in Bangladesh airspace back to being human again when she flies home? I mean, this is the absurdity of the viability standard. It has never worked. It didn't work in Roe, and it doesn't work now.
Well, it underscores the broader absurdity of all of those incremental kind of assessments of human value and human worth. The SLED test is the classic way of characterizing it: size, level of development, environment, or degree of dependency. The last is the one we're talking about right now. But it just strikes me as unusual that, given the language of viability in Roe, the timing has not shifted in light of the new science, and the court hasn't acknowledged that. 24 weeks, wherever they got that, I don't know. Maybe that was more or less the age at which a child, if it's born at that age, it can be saved. If not, they can't save it. But that's not true anymore. So with the advancing technology, that was never taken into consideration in subsequent legislation, apparently. It was just locked down in Roe.
Well,
am I right about that?
You are, but here's one thing I'll add to that. The truth is that the Roe court was given excellent fetal development and scientific evidence, even in 1972, when this case was being argued. And they ignored that evidence. They just decided to set it aside. And they punted to, people disagree on when life begins, so who's to say what the right answer is, while they're ignoring very compelling scientific evidence on embryology, the beginning of life. So even in 1972, the court had evidence. It just chose not to deal with it. And I think that problem has persisted. Now it's even worse because we've got much more evidence. But even in 72, they had adequate evidence to make the right call. They just chose not to.
You know, part of the complaint, I'm trying to think of how each side is positioning themselves, both legally and rhetorically here. My sense so far is that what the legal team supporting the Dobbs issue, of course, I'm not sure anymore how to describe this. So Dobbs, what is Dobbs? Is Dobbs the law that is being defended? Help me out with the terminology here. I know Roe was Jane Roe, and she, you know, and that's how that was named. Okay, so those who are defending Dobbs, which is the legislation in Mississippi, they are trying to make a very clean, crisp legal case, okay? When I hear some of the people talking about this on the other side, and even justices, I think, making reference to this looking like a political football. Oh, so we're going to overturn precedent just to satisfy one political party. So they are characterizing it as a political football or a political issue rather than a juridical issue, a real genuine question of the judicial propriety of Roe.
Well, here's the irony of that. Yeah, you're right. Our opponents are framing it exactly that way. They're claiming, oh, we shouldn't politicize this issue. We should leave it with the court. Well, here's the problem. The court in Roe v. Wade and in Planned Parenthood versus Casey legislated from the bench by inserting its own political views into the judicial process. So if you want to take politics out of this, the thing to do is kick it back to the states, not leave it with the courts. Yeah. The other irony is, you know, people love to say, I don't want the federal government involved in abortion. That's why I want to keep Roe v. Wade. Well, wait a minute. Do you realize that one branch of the federal government, the federal courts, is totally involved in abortion? In fact, it's ruled out the other two branches from having any voice in this. So if you want to get politics out of the government, the thing you ought to do then is give it back to the people to have their own voice on the issue, not leave it with the courts who have politicized it.
You know, Scott, one of the evidences to me that this is not political on the side that are I don't even want to say on the pro-life side. I want the side that is arguing to defend Dobbs, the Mississippi law. OK, it's not political because if this was a pro-life sentiment that was driving this, this was the rationale. Never mind the emotions or personal convictions. Those are not on the table. But the legal rationale, they would not kick it back to the states because their point would be abortion is wrong. It takes the life of an innocent human being without proper justification, and no state should allow that.
Right.
But the fact that they're willing to kick it back to the states is evidence that what they're saying is the Supreme Court has no legitimate jurisdiction. The federal government has no legitimate I don't know if jurisdiction is the right word, but legitimate or appropriate role in adjudicating this from the bench because it is not a constitutional issue. It was made that way 48 years ago, and now that needs to be undone, and we have to treat it in a totally different way. And that may mean, of course, like you said, going back to the states, and then the merits of the pro-life view can be adjudicated in the legislature. What happens in the court is a matter of what the Constitution actually says. At least that's the way it's supposed to work.
Yeah, and you and I would agree the federal government does have a role protecting unborn children because the federal government is there to protect the natural rights of its citizens. Now, natural rights are those rights you have in virtue of your humanity. For example, Greg, you and I do not have a right to vote in the next United Kingdom election. for the simple reason we're not citizens of that nation. But we certainly have a right not to be gunned down in the middle of Trafalgar Square anytime we visit London. That latter right is not a political right that a government grants us. It's a human right intrinsic to our nature as human beings. Mm-hmm. And the federal government of the United States has a duty to uphold and protect those pre-political laws that you and I have in virtue of our humanity. So you and I would make the argument that the federal government does have a role to uphold natural rights and liberties, and therefore it ought to uphold the natural right of the unborn to live. But what we're talking about here is the federal courts co-opting the abortion issue and deciding that they alone have a voice in this, and they alone will determine abortion policy. That is not constitutional, and that needs to be undone.
Yeah, this is, and I agree with everything you said, and I just want to draw a line, very clearly, underneath the distinction that you've just made, and that is we have a government with different responsibilities, okay? The legislature has a responsibility, the courts have a responsibility, the executive has a responsibility. What the court did 48 years ago was to exceed its responsibility in the way it used the Constitution. That is something that should have happened in the legislature. So I'm not against at all if Roe is undone because it's bad policy or it's bad adjudication of the Constitution is a better way to put it. Then it can be left up either to the states or the federal government to protect its citizens in an appropriate way. And its citizens would be any human being under its proper jurisdiction, which would include, arguably, the unborn. I'm just tossing the arguably out there because, to be nice, we have our convictions because we have very strong reasons for acknowledging the full humanity and the full value of every human being at every stage of that human's human life, which is from the moment of conception when that human life begins. And that's not religion, that's science. And by the way, I'm trying to remember, since I just scanned materials, somebody made some comment about religion being invoked in this process. Was
Sotomayor
that one of the justices?
That.
It was.
Yeah. Yeah. And she was basically arguing that the pro-life position had no real standing apart from religion. That was her basic claim. Now, this is a bogus argument, as you and I know. Look, arguments are valid or invalid, sound or unsound. Calling an argument religious is a dodge. It's not a refutation. As our good friend Frank Beckwith says, it's a category error like asking how tall is the number three. Look, you've got to evaluate the argument based on evidence, not dismiss it because you call it a name, religious. Yes. And that's what she was attempting to do.
So how long does this particular deliberation go on? Or maybe it's over with. I'm not following it day for day here. I know that the decision will not come out until probably June. What's the schedule like on this?
Yeah, June is when we expect it. As you know, the oral arguments are real quick. You are there less than an hour. But
really?
The reality is that the decision will not be released until, I'm going to guess, late June. And though I'm optimistic, Greg, we were optimistic in 1992 with the Casey decision. We thought that Roe was on life support at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, we ended up with a mess on our hands when Souter, O'Connor, and who was the other one? Kennedy sabotaged our plans. And these were all Reagan and Bush appointees who did this. So I want to be a little bit cautious, but I think this time around, the court realizes that it really doesn't have a way to go here. It's either got to strike down the Mississippi law and affirm or reaffirm Roe and Casey, which I don't think many justices want to do because they recognize how bad these decisions are. They are precisely what the other side is saying we shouldn't do. They're politicized decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're going to have to get rid of Roe and Casey to uphold a ban on abortion that bans the procedure before viability. Otherwise, the court's in the awkward position of creating a new line. Well, we're not going to use viability. Let's use consciousness. Let's use having a concept of self. Well, that's just going to create another mess. Why is it that line and not something else? It's completely arbitrary. Or it's going to have to move the viability line and say, well, you know what? Technology now is maybe more at 19 to 21 weeks, so we'll move it to there. And but then they got to strike down the Mississippi law or somehow rewrite it to make it fit that standard. So I think that's why the legal experts are saying, no, there's really no way around this. They've either got to uphold the Mississippi law and strike Roe and Casey, or strike down the Mississippi law and uphold Roe and Casey.
Well, I know we've got a clear majority of conservative justices, and I mean those that are constitutionally conservative. Roberts, it's hard to know which way he's going to go. He's been a mixed bag lately, and that's been a little scary to me for a number of reasons. But in any event, it may be, though, that apart from a clear majority that would wipe Roe out, there may be a willingness by a majority to make adjustments to Roe. It won't be what we want, but if they move the viability, if they move that back and even change the wording or something, for whatever reason, even though it's arbitrary, any attempt, any moving that crucial date back from, 24 weeks to 15 or 10 or whatever, is going to help states pass legislation that will save more babies. But it also might represent, at least in the meantime, in the temporary, a compromise that allows something to change against Roe, even though Roe is not wiped out.
Well, I might take a slightly different view on that. I think that if the court does not deal with Roe and Casey with this case, it could be years before they get another case perfectly suited to do it. But the other thing is, I think it would absolutely demoralize political conservatives who want a rule of law government and who are bothered that Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey have not done that. And can you imagine what it would do to the conservative voting bloc that's out there to see Roe and Casey stand through all of this when a case was presented? Imagine what it's going to do to their belief that electing pro-life presidents makes a difference. I think it would shatter their confidence. And I think it would be a defeat, much the same way that Casey was a defeat. Because remember, Casey allowed certain abortion control legislation. It allowed, for example, parental notification, I believe. I forget what the other two things it allowed. It disallowed spousal notification. But the problem with Casey was it upheld the essential finding of Roe. And if the court does that again, I worry that it's going to demoralize our side to the point where they're going to start checking out of politics. And that's going to be disaster for the rule of law. And it's going to be disaster for our political future moving forward.
Yeah, I'm glad you put it that way. It's a disaster for the rule of law, because this is precisely what's at stake here. And I just wanted to underscore this again. This decision is not about whether someone is pro-life or pro-choice.
That's right.
This decision is about what the Constitution dictates and allows.
Absolutely.
And the minute you make the Constitution like a wax nose, you can twist it and turn it whichever way you want, all it takes is a shift in the court for the other side's ox to get gored by the same rationale. And that kind of constitution protects no one.
No one.
Think of this a lot, Scott, when they talk about the living constitution. Don't you believe the Constitution is alive? Of course it's alive. It's alive with its original intent.
Correct.
If it's not alive with that, it's not alive at all. The only thing that's alive is the imaginations of the judges sitting on the bench at any given time.
Yeah.
And that doesn't protect us, and I've thought of it in another way too. Our founders made it really, really difficult to amend the Constitution. It is not easy to do, okay? And they did that for a reason, all right? How is it then, with the so-called living constitution approach, you can de facto amend a constitution with the vote of six people who are not elected?
Yeah.
Six judges, or five. Mm-hmm. That's right, five. That's mm-hmm. all you need. And right. and then they can just change the meaning if our approach to these kinds of questions are living constitution approaches. There is no constitution left in it. By the way, people do the same thing with the Bible.
Yes,
know?
They do. Yes.
And I don't mean living Bible like the translation. I mean they treat the meaning of the Bible as something they can bend and twist according to their own whim at the moment. And when exactly. that happens, the Bible is no longer the authority. It is people's whim that is the authority. And the same thing is true here in this discussion.
Well, people sometimes ask me, have you ever met the Pope? I said, I've met 1,000 of them who interpret the Bible according to the way they think it is to be interpreted, and they think it's authoritative. They don't realize there's an objective text there. You know, what you were just saying reminds me of kind of a funny line that Ramesh Panuru said in the Party of Death book he wrote. He said, isn't it funny that in the mind of the modern left today, the Constitution is a living, breathing document, but a fetus is not? I think that sums it up perfectly of where we are
that
today.
Is. Well, I have. If you have some more time, I have some more things yep. I want to press you on. Let's take a break, and then let's come back. And I want to move forward a little bit more with some broader issues that relate to this question. Scott Klusendorf, the founder and director, president.
President,
what is your
time? Fine.
Yep. Now, hold on. See, when you found the organization, you can make yourself anything you want. Right. But the organization is Life Training Institute LTI. We'll be back in just a moment. Friends, if you like this broadcast, I know you'll love hashtag STRAsk. It's our shorter 20-minute podcast where I am paired with the wonderful Amy Hall, and together we answer the questions you send us on Twitter. Hashtag STRAsk is released twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays, and it's only about 20 minutes long, so it's perfect to listen to on your morning jog or while driving around running errands or cleaning your garage or just plain loafing at home. Amy and I tackle your questions on theology and ethics and culture and lots more, offering our insight on the questions you're asking or the challenges you face. You can listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your own shows. Just remember, send us your questions on Twitter using the name of the podcast, hashtag STRAsk. That's hashtag STRAsk. You know, if you've gained anything from listening to Stand to Reason, I'd really be thrilled to hear from you. I love to take your questions, of course, but I also want your feedback. So here's what you can do. Head over to iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave us a rating and a review. That kind of thing really helps us to get the word out so more ambassadors for Christ can find the show and become equipped to stand confidently. And you never know, I might just give you a shout out on the air to show you my appreciation for your positive review. I value you as a faithful listener. I look forward to reading what you think about the show. Thanks. All right, friends, Greg Kokel here, back with you with my guest, founder, president, director, chief cook and bottle washer of Life Training Institute. Actually, it's a very significant organization. My wife and I have been supporting LTI for years and years and years because it's one of the most important pro-life organizations in the country. Doing advocacy, not doing marches. Oh, good for marches. But these are things that what they do change people's minds on the issue of abortion or train others who are pro-life to change the minds of pro-choicers. So it's great the work you're doing, Scott.
We're thankful for you and Stand to Reason. You know, it's funny, people out on the road will say, you remind me of Greg Kokel. And I think, I wonder why. Of course, the things I've learned from you. And I want to throw a funny story at your viewers real quick. Do you remember when I first joined STR, I was scheduled to debate Eileen McDonough? And she backed out of the debate.
Oh, yeah.
At the last
that's right.
Minute.
It was somewhere in Illinois, I think.
Illinois, University of Illinois. And I was all geared up for that debate. I was loaded for Grizzly. And then she backs out due to pressure from pro-abortion students. And I was madder than a hornet. I was penning an op-ed to the school newspaper, and I sent it to you. Thank God I sent it to you. And you said, you know, maybe we can just tone this thing down a little bit. And I looked back at that original draft a while back. I'm like, oh, my goodness, I almost sent that. And you really helped craft it. And this is part of the ambassador skills you learn when you hang around Stand to Reason. You learn to be an articulate but artful defender. I needed a little more art, and I'm really grateful for the time I got to develop that with you at Stand to Reason.
Well, that's really sweet, Scott. Now, like you mentioned, I do remember, for one, I remember you included that story in I think, in the foreword or introduction or whatever to your book, which I have not mentioned yet. So this is a good segue.
Well, that's the only reason I said something nice about you is to set up my book.
The Case for Life. Yeah. And you got to that title before Lee did. Good
no,
for you.
He had his first.
Oh, he did? Oh,
he
okay.
Did.
Well, I know titles are not copyrightable, but that's an appropriate title.
And I didn't choose it. The publisher did, actually.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Yep.
Well, I'm glad that you wrote the book because you have so much to offer this area. And for those who want a thoroughgoing assessment and analysis of the pro-life view and how best to position yourself in the public square, making your case not only with individuals but also with groups, The Case for Life is your book. Scott Klusendorf is the author. Now, Scott, we've been talking about the Dobbs case and the importance, the significance of that. I did want to offer another question about it. Do you, I know you said you don't want to be too optimistic because you don't want to be let down, but given the makeup of the court and also what ends up happening a lot of times in these discussions, by the way, those arguments were December 1st, I think, about a week ago, that their justices often give clues as to which way they're leaning in the way they ask their questions. So do you have a sense at all in which way you think this is going to go in light of the way the justices talked and interviewed and interrogated the attorneys representing both sides of this case?
I'll go out on a limb, and you'll be able to throw it back at me if I'm wrong. I think it's going to be a 6-3 decision in favor of overturning Roe and Casey, and the court will do a full upholding of the Mississippi law.
Wow. Wow.
That's based on the questioning, but more than the questioning, because it's kind of hard to read the tea leaves when you're just watching the oral arguments.
Sure.
More than once, we've been fooled by that. I mean, we all thought Obamacare was toast listening to the oral arguments. I mean, nobody thought that thing was going to survive, and yet look what happened.
Roberts.
So that's the wild card here. The more persuasive thing to me is that the court does not seem to have any wiggle room here. It's either got to give a full throttle support to the status quo, Roe v. Wade and Casey, or it's got to trash that and allow the 15-week ban, which happens 9 weeks before viability. So I don't think the court has much wiggle room here. I think it's going to have to move forward with getting rid of Roe v. Wade. And it's not going to be because we've got a bunch of justices that are solidly pro-life. It's like you say, we've got justices who would rather have the rule of law than a case on the books that looks like sausage making.
Mm-hmm. Well, what you also made reference to was a very compelling case that the pro-Dobbs legal team offered. And to me, this is really important. If you can offer a case that is solid on the merits, now what? And I don't know what the other side offered, except for a kind of stare decisis. This is what we decided a long time ago, and we can't change it because then the court will look unstable or something like
right.
that. I actually don't know. I did hear a little echo of that kind of thing, but I don't know if there's anything substantial on the other side of a legal nature.
Well, I thought Brett Kavanaugh did a great job of dealing with that whole stare decisis issue. Look, Plessy versus Ferguson would still be the law of the land if we can't change court history here. And this is one of the damaging things of Planned Parenthood versus Casey, because that decision, which reaffirmed the essential holding of Roe, basically told everybody to shut up and leave the decision to the court, because if they didn't shut up, the court would become destabilized and the reputation of the court would be harmed. And we all ought to just go away and let the judges handle this, is basically what they were telling us. That's garbage. We are a constitutional republic. The people ought to have a say in these issues. And yet here was the Supreme Court in Planned Parenthood versus Casey trying to rob us of that. And that's what Roe has brought to us. This attitude of judicial tyranny that says the courts alone determine truth, determine jurisprudence, and everybody else can go burn. That's the essential logic in play here, and that just has to be undone.
This Plessy versus Ferguson, as I recall, this was the separate but equal
segregation
justification for segregation.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
And that went that's gone, and justifiably so.
And yeah, and by the way, it took 58 years to overturn that. We're only at 48 with Roe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. That's great. One of the things I want to shift now to Texas for a second. Because the Texas legislation also survived judicial review as far as it went, and it had a very, very unusual approach to this question of abortion. Why don't you tell us about that? And I want to talk maybe a little bit more about, regardless of what happens in June, or if maybe it's bad news or whatever, that doesn't mean that we don't have creative ways to continue dealing with this issue. Tell us about the Texas statute.
Well, very briefly, the Texas law, which some have called a heartbeat law, banning abortion after 6 weeks, is an interesting case. And you're right. The court, well, I should say we need to clarify something. The court has not affirmed that case. It has simply refused to enjoin it, throw it out. That's all that's happened.
Good
because
distinction.
The court did not feel that the Texas law was some, you know, draconian violation that they had to step in immediately and stop it. So it's left it alone for the moment. But keep in mind, it will eventually come up because you know that there's going to be other federal courts that seek to enjoin it. And I'm certain that that may happen. The Texas law, though, had this rather interesting part that law enforcement, the state itself would not prosecute people who violated the abortion restrictions, but individual citizens anywhere in the country could. That's a very interesting approach. So, for example, if you wanted to sue an abortionist for performing an illegal abortion beyond the 6 weeks, and you happen to be a truck driver in Austin, Texas, or one in Bangor, Maine, it wouldn't matter. You could, as a private citizen, bring suit against that abortionist. So it basically turned the whole country into prosecutors at that point. Very interesting indeed.
So this under tort law, though, I mean, having a not criminal law, but rather tort law, so they could sue them, essentially.
Right.
And incidentally, in tort law, you don't need beyond a reasonable doubt. You just need 51% to 49%. I mean, the criterion is different.
Right.
And did the court not step in because it felt that there was nothing constitutionally at stake with the wording of the law?
I think that's it, yeah. Again, and you've made this distinction, and I hope all our viewers are catching it. The issue here is not pro-life or pro-choice. The court wasn't looking at the Texas law.
The legal issue. The legal
issue. It's a legal issue. What's the Constitution say here? And the fact that the court chose not to get overly involved in the Texas law, I think gives me a little hope that that may be what we're looking at for the Dobbs case. We'll have to see, of course, but does give me a little hope there.
Well, in that case, they just, if they do with the Dobbs case like they did with the Texas case, unless I'm misunderstanding
you. No, I don't want them to do what they did. What I'm saying is it signaled to me that the court isn't looking to expand its power, its role on abortion.
Oh, I see.
It's,
okay.
I think, looking to vacate, step back, get out of it. This has been messy for them. I would imagine they would love to see a situation where they saw fewer abortion cases, not more. And to do that, they've got to deal decisively with Roe and Casey.
Well, it reminds me of President Clinton when he said abortion should be rare, safe but rare. And then the question becomes, why should they be rare?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Safe,
you know,
legal, and rare, but why?
That's right. Safe, legal, and rare was the thing. This Texas case reminds me just a little bit about kind of the political maneuvering, legislative maneuvering that William Wilberforce pulled off with his cronies to effectively limit and stop the slavery, or at least the bulk of slavery, at least a step, the slave trade, because they passed this law that they tried not to draw any attention to that had to do with flying of flags. I just watched the movie again, Amazing Grace, right, a couple of weeks ago, and it was just a little maneuver that had the effect of significantly depressing the slave trade, even though they couldn't outright make it illegal. So that I thought was clever there, and this case in Texas seems to be similar. Let's try an end around that's going to have the effect that we're looking for, even though it's a somewhat of a boutique way of accomplishing that from a legal perspective. I'm curious if there are any other things like that that are potentials. My understanding, and here's where you could help me out here, my understanding is that the issue of personhood was not ever addressed by Roe. It was left aside, and it seems to me there was some kind of side comment. If the unborn were considered persons regarding the law, well, then the 14th Amendment would apply to them, equal protection under the law. And wasn't there a strategy to try to accomplish that, to declare humanity and legal personhood from the time of conception?
Yeah, there is a move underfoot right now by some pro-lifers to declare the unborn persons based on the 14th Amendment. And there are some credible people arguing that we can do that. And there's other scholars saying, no, that's not going to work. But here's what's interesting about the whole personhood question as applies to Roe. The Supreme Court, and again, this is from our good friend Frank Beckwith. As Beckwith points out, the Supreme Court in Roe v. Wade said the right to an abortion hinged on the status of the unborn. That is, whether or not the unborn were persons. The court then said it didn't know if the unborn were persons. Therefore, as Frank points out, it also doesn't know if there's a right to an abortion. So the Supreme Court's logic in Roe is literally self-refuting. And it's quite comical to see their attempts to dance around this.
Well, this reminds me of an illustration I think we both used back in the day when we were on a team together and working out some of these things. For people who say, we don't know when life begins, okay, or to the court's language, we don't know when a fetus becomes a person, okay? So we're going to blow that building up.
Right.
Is there anyone inside? We don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, so what do you do in a circumstance like that? You don't push the plunger. You don't blow it up if you don't know. So agnosticism on either of these questions, life or personhood, inveighs against abortion liberties, not in favor of abortion liberties.
Exactly.
And I don't know why that wasn't obvious.
President Reagan once said, if you're out hunting and you see bushes rustling and you don't know if it's your best buddy or that deer you've been after, are you going to open fire? Maybe if you're Dick Cheney, but other than that, you're not going to do that. That's a joke for the older part of the audience, those that remember
right.
Dick Cheney accidentally shot his friend while out hunting.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
So you made a reference. We got about 10 minutes more here, so I just want to kind of squeeze you for as much as you got in this, Scott. You made a reference earlier to a strategy with courts, and particularly on this issue, where the court will adjudicate in a narrow way or in a more broad way. Can you explain the distinction between those things legally?
Sometimes a court will try to rule what we call very narrowly, where it will uphold the technicalities of a law, but make it clear that it's not setting the groundwork for any other law similar to this one. It is just ruling basically on the narrow merits of that particular law. But then there are other times, like what happened in Roe v. Wade, where the Supreme Court or the federal courts will say, we are determining what the standard is, what the law will be. This is a very expansive and broad ruling that applies to all 50 states, and everybody's got to get in line with it. And with this Dobbs case, we are back to a chance for the court to rule broadly that Roe v. Wade— Planned Parenthood versus Casey are bad law. I mean, the history in Roe v. Wade is atrocious. Justice Blackmun relied on a historian by the name of Cyril Means, who basically argued that the pro-life laws that were enacted in the 1860s were only put on the books to protect the health of women, not protect the fetus. That was flat out wrong. Those laws were absolutely on the books to protect unborn human life, and we had unbelievable amounts of documented history to prove that. And Justice Blackmun focused only on Cyril Means's flawed approach and ignored everybody else. And then you look at the logic of Roe, which we just talked about. It's literally self-refuting. Then you look at the damage it's done. It's co-opted the issue from the other two branches of government and resulted in a slew of other abortion decisions that have been poorly decided. So there needs to be a broad and expansive rejection of the jurisprudence surrounding Roe and Casey, not a narrow upholding of the Mississippi law that allows Roe and Casey to stand.
This brings up another question for me about balance of power, because as it stands right now, and you've probably done more thinking about this than I have, so maybe you have an answer, maybe not. But the idea is that there's to be a balance between, the three branches of government. Not that one branch holds veto power, strictly speaking, over the others. How is it then it's come to a point where the Supreme Court really has the last say? And the legislature or the executive branch have no recourse for saying the Supreme Court did poorly here. We're not supporting it. I don't know what even that looks like, if it's ever been done in American history or not, but balance means balance, okay?
Right.
One is holding the other in check, but the way it is now, de facto, is the Supreme Court is the supreme decision maker. Once they decide, end of issue, it's all over.
Well, Lincoln, in his presidency, did defy Dred Scott, but he didn't defy the authority of the court in general. He just defied its authority on that decision.
On that issue, right.
Yeah.
And that's what I have in mind here.
Right.
Individual decisions, not the legitimacy of the institution itself.
But you have identified a real problem here, this concept of judicial supremacy, where the executive and legislative branches essentially have to submit to the federal courts. At that point, we're a nation ruled by judges. What difference does it make if we elect people according to our own wishes, when ultimately it's going to be judges who rule us? And you could make a good case, as many authors have, that we have become a nation ruled by judges. In fact, the magazine First Things did a symposium on this a number of years ago, and they had people like Justice Bork, and they had Hadley Arkus, I think maybe even Robert George was in there, all making the point that that's really where we're coming up against here. And that is a problem. At some point, the legislative and executive branches are going to have to assert themselves and say, wait a minute, we need to restore some balance. And I'm actually hopeful, maybe I'm naive, that this particular court would like to go that way, that they would like to move toward seeing more of a balance of power. They're not wanting the courts to have that much power.
Right.
We'll see if
right.
I'm right, but that's my inkling.
So if this in June, the court kicks us to the states, is that something that happens immediately? Once the decision is made, it becomes applicable, correct? Then there is no, I mean, if they say in June, we support Dobbs because Dobbs is defensible in its own self, and it's right because Casey and Roe no longer have standing, okay? They reverse Casey Roe. All right. Then immediately, if I understand this correctly, the individual states can then pursue their own legislative agendas with regards to abortion in their states.
Exactly. And it gets even better than that. There are some states that have trigger laws ready to go. The minute the federal courts are out of the way, there are laws already ready teed up to go that kick in.
Oh, I remember when some of the debates about the new justices were in play, but it's not just pro-life states, but New right. York's done the same thing. So right. they've got their own trigger laws. They're ready to kick them into place. What do you think the breakdown is going to be state-wise, not state mm-hmm. by state, but just numbers-wise, más o menos, with regards to this issue?
You know, it's funny. Before Roe versus Wade, 31 states passed laws, or I should say 31 states refused to liberalize their laws. 19 states did. I think mm-hmm. it'll be exactly the opposite. I think now it would be 19 states or so will pass some very significant restrictions on abortion, and maybe another 20 will pass laws the other way. I mean, look, the blue states are going to go hard pro-abortion. We all know that. But again, we'll still have a better situation than we have right now, where no state has the authority to restrict this evil. At least now some states will, and we will see lives saved because of it. And that's a good thing.
Yeah. I wonder if that trend, and you and I exchanged some emails last week or so on this, but I wonder if that trend is to some degree influenced by the fact that we've had almost half a century of liberalized abortion practices, and people are just used to it, and it just seems okay to them.
I think you're entirely correct on this. Look, there's this saying you hear in church circles all the times, oh, you got to change hearts before you change laws. Or the more sophisticated version of that, politics is always downstream from culture. I don't think it always is, Greg. I think it's both and, not either or. Sometimes the law, as Aristotle pointed out, acts as a moral tutor that points people a certain way. You look at civil rights legislation in the South. Prior to the 1964 Civil Rights Act, a majority of Southerners opposed civil rights for blacks. Within 2 years of passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964, a majority of Southerners supported the new legislation. The law was a moral teacher.
Yeah, it's so interesting to see that. Reason we exchanged emails is because I'm writing a piece on that. It'll come out in January, and it's to some degree it's to correct this faulty thinking that only a change of heart is going to change a people.
Right.
We don't train our kids that way.
No.
We don't say, okay, no rules for you because it's only the Holy Spirit that can do
right.
the job. These things do work together.
Yep.
Look, we're almost out of time. I just want to mention your book again because it's so important. It's simply called The Case for Life. It's very easy to remember the title. The Case for Life, Scott Klusendorf. He's the founder, president, and director and chief trainer over at Life Training Institute, doing a fabulous job. Scott, quickly give us your website so people can go there if they'd like to.
ProLifeTraining.com, all one word, ProLifeTraining.com. I appreciate you, brother. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you, Scott. I'm just letting people know, reminding my wife and I support Scott's organization. This is the end of year. I'm sure they'd appreciate the gift. ProLifeTraining.com, right, Scott?
That's it.
Great to see you again, buddy. Bye-bye.
Good to see you, Greg.
All right. And that's it for this hour, friends. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven, all right? Bye-bye now.